Welcome back. Last time I talked about the challenges of archaeology in West Africa, and particularly the area around the inland Niger Delta of Mali. I spoke about our archaeological understandings of how complex societies appeared on this part of the African continent. These included a whole set of issues about the development of agriculture and settlement hierarchy in what's now the Southern Sahara, at places like Dartichet in Mauritania, now desert. Questions of trade and the development of trade, and especially the trans-Saharan trade, as we try and understand how this trade developed in the first millennium AD, and actually, potentially, whether it may have existed in earlier times as well, as the Sahara dried out. And the roles that, yet again, because this is a theme in a whole variety of different areas that we looked at, the roles that exotic goods, goods coming from far away, may have played in the pathways to social hierarchy at sites like Kisi, that cemetery site in northeastern Burkina Faso. I talked about the development of urbanism in the inland Niger itself in the first millennium AD, and what may be some diversity in political and social structures in the region, because, as I noted last time, there's no reason necessarily to think that everything has to work in exactly the same way within a particular cultural region. I want to note especially the multi-ethnic nature of life in the inland Niger Delta today. Extremely complex relationships between different ethnic groups and occupational groups. Potentially, I think quite likely, this was the case in the past as well, and this may be related to these urban clusters, this particular form of urbanism that we see, for example, at the great site of Djenigeno in the inland Niger Delta. In parts of Africa, and in many other areas of the world as well, of course, these paths towards statehood are not always well understood at all, often because much less research has been done in such areas. This is certainly the case in the Lake Chad Basin of Central Africa, now partitioned between the modern states of Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, and the area where I do most of my archaeological research. I started working in northern Cameroon in the Lake Chad Basin in 1984, which seems like an extraordinarily long time ago now, at the beginning of my PhD program. I did my PhD there over the next 10 years, and I've been working there on and off ever since. After working for some years on a contract archaeology project involving the Chad-Cameroon oil pipeline, where we surveyed along a 700-mile stretch of oil pipeline right away in southern Cameroon and Chad, I'm now back working in northern Cameroon again. It's a lovely area of the world, amazing area of the world, with a tremendous cultural diversity and really extraordinary people. And the region that I work in particularly, the Mandara Mountains of northern Cameroon and northern Nigeria, are one of the most lovely areas I've ever seen. As with the inland Niger Delta and the Nile Valley, the Lake Chad Basin was very much affected by environmental changes around the Sahara over the last 10,000 years. And this is something that I noted, parallel processes in the inland Niger Delta and around that region more generally. During that very wet early Holocene, Lake Chad expanded. This was the time period through which, as I said, the Sahara virtually disappears as a desert, replaced by a network of rivers and lakes, grassland, savanna, in what's now the Sahara. During this period, Lake Chad expanded vastly, becoming a real inland sea that archaeologists and climatologists call Lake Megachad. and with connections to the network of rivers and lakes that existed through the Sahara at this time. I've already noted that we really must recalibrate our expectations of African climates through this area, and this affects all sorts of different cultural patterns and processes. In the early Holocene, we always think today of the Sahara as a barrier to interchange between sub-Saharan Africa and the Mediterranean basin. But during the early and mid-Holocene, the Sahara was a pathway, a passage used by people to move from one area to another. It was an extraordinarily productive environment, one that people made great use of. So we really have to rethink our expectations about cultural history in this region, because these changed climates would have affected every aspect of human culture over a vast area, really from the Mediterranean itself to the equator. During this period, between about 8,000 BC and 2500 BC, first cattle pastoralism, and then in some regions, agriculture, probably associated with the farming of millet, an indigenous African cereal, possibly sorghum as well, were developed in what's now the southern Sahara, places like, as I noted last time, Dartichet. Regions to the south were probably too wet to allow cereal agriculture and similar kinds of activities, certainly too wet for pastoralism. And they probably would have been occupied by hunting and gathering, foraging communities, at fairly low population densities. This issue was complicated because there are questions about the antiquity, the age of farming of tuber crops like yams in the tropical forests of Central Africa. These crops, these tuber crops, yams for example, we know have an ancient history in the region, but because it's tropical forest and because of the nature of the crops, they don't tend to preserve in archaeological sites. And so trying to examine the agricultural history of some of these other non-cereal crops is a real challenge for archaeologists. As in the inland Niger Delta, the gradual desiccation, the gradual drying out of the southern Sahara in the mid-Holocene pushed people further to the south. It became too dry to support cattle pastoralism, too dry to support agriculture. And of course, at the same time, because this drying climate was regional, it affected not just the desert, this also made environments around the now shrinking Lake Megachad more hospitable for human occupation, particularly by pastoralists and farmers. And people take advantage of this. Village sites from what's known as the Gajigana culture first appear southwest of Lake Chad in what's now northern Nigeria, northeastern Nigeria particularly, at about 1800 BC. The cultural affinities of the Gajigana occupation, the ceramics, the stone tools, the bone tools, seem to be with the southern Sahara, probably from somewhere around the Ayer Mountains in the central Sahara. Gajigana people appear initially to have been pastoralists, cattle pastoralists, who also harvested wild grains, with domesticated millet becoming important only some centuries after this initial occupation of the regions southwest of Lake Chad. Use of only wild grains by sedentary village populations is somewhat unusual. So these initial occupations by Gajigana people were not farming, they were harvesting wild grains. But this can be explained by the great expanse and the tremendous productivity of stands of wild grasses south of Lake Chad. People did not have to cultivate in order to support themselves in one place. Those immense stands of wild grasses still exist in the area today, and those wild grasses are still used during periods of crop failure, during droughts, for example, by populations in the Lake Chad Basin. And this is probably the way domestication of cereal crops happened in different parts of the world in the first place. We know at this time period, by the time that Gadjigana people are settling this region, that millet farming is established in places like Dartichit, but it may just have been easier for these populations to use wild grasses because there's so much food available. By the middle of the first millennium BC, some of the descendants of these early Gadjigana settlers in the Lake Chad Basin were living in large villages like Zelum, which is about 32 acres in area and was occupied by perhaps 2,500 people southwest of Lake Chad. Other sites in this region are even larger. Malankari, for example, which covers 75 acres, but has not been as extensively investigated as Zelum has. And so archaeologists are not certain whether the population would have been proportionately as large, perhaps twice as large, as at Zelum. But these are significantly large village sites. Zelum is a flat site. It's an extraordinary site, just carpeted with pottery from this occupation 2,500 years ago. But the full extent of sites like Zelum has been only revealed through the use of remote sensing techniques, the sorts of techniques that we can use to gain an idea of archaeological sites before excavation, and in this case specifically magnetometry, which reveals the disturbances that buried archaeological features, pits, ditches, hearths, iron smelting furnaces, and so on, generate in the Earth's magnetic field. Magnetometry allows us to detect extremely minor differences in the Earth's magnetic field of the sort that can be caused simply by soil disturbance. On large sites like Zelum or Malankari, Africanist archaeologists have not had the resources to do the kind of very large-scale excavations that would allow us to determine the site's overall plan or features. I mean, these are extremely large sites with very little, except dense masses of broken pottery, visible on the surface. A surface magnetometry survey allows us to build up a really very, very useful map of buried archaeological features, and thus we can plan more limited excavations in an organized manner. And this work at Zelum was undertaken by a German archaeologist only about 10 years ago, so that our understanding, the transformation in our understanding of these sites, is really very, very recent. As I said, in areas like the southern basin of Lake Chad, archaeological understanding of social and political complexity is very much a work in progress, which is one of the things that makes it so exciting. In fact, we would never have known about the size and complexity of these sites without this magnetometry survey. Because, as I noted, there's not very much visible on the surface. And this is actually a general issue in archaeology. How do we prioritize our work, especially excavation, which is very time and effort intensive, with only limited knowledge of what's in the ground beforehand? These Lake Chad Basin sites have seen some of the first extensive magnetometry surveys in Africa over just the last few years, as I noted. There has been some limited use of similar kinds of techniques in southern Africa, but this is a new and very exciting technological development that really opens up the potential for a transformation in our understanding of these sites. People always expect from the media that the challenge of archaeology is finding archaeological sites. For the most part, the challenge isn't finding sites. It's finding the archaeologists to do all the work that needs to be done. And these techniques, these remote sensing techniques, allow us to do our work more efficiently. And they're becoming more and more important in archaeologists because they allow us to do more intelligent digging and because they allow us to learn things about a site that would be impossible to learn through any conceivable excavation program. And Zeelum is a good illustration of this. The magnetometry survey, which took in virtually the whole site, revealed that hundreds of buried pit features are scattered all across the site. They're not visible on the surface, but they're there under about a meter and a half of later sediment. These probably correspond to storage pits for grain and or garbage pits, and they're almost certainly associated with individual households, a set of pits for an individual household. Perhaps more important, Zeelum was surrounded by a ditch. In total, almost a kilometer or 0.6 mile long, and revealed by excavation, because as I said, this allows us to target excavation in areas that we're particularly interested in. The ditch was revealed by excavation to be about 3 meters or 10 feet deep in some places. We know from subsequent magnetometry survey on other sites of the same period southwest of Lake Chad that these as well have similar ditch features, some smaller and some larger in size. What would such ditches be used for? At present, their function is unclear. This is one of the areas that's going to require more work and probably more excavation. However, one obvious use would be as part of a ditch and rampart defensive system, where the earth excavated from the ditch would be used to build up the rampart, probably inside the ditch. If this is the case at Zeelum, that has significant implications because it would imply important levels of intercommunity conflict in the Lake Chad Basin, much earlier than anyone had expected. A ditch and rampart system at Zeelum at 500 BC would be probably 1,000 years before anybody had expected to find such systems in the region. And if we take conflict as some indication of the intensity of occupation, which does make sense, given the conflict is very often conflict about resources, this implies high occupational intensity, lots of occupation in this region southwest of Lake Chad, as of course does as well the existence of all of these large village sites. So these village-sized communities seem to have proliferated and diversified south of Lake Chad during the first millennium AD. So we have a continuation of occupation, a spread and diversification of these large village sites after 500 BC up through the first millennium AD. And some of these sites, again, were certainly walled. I really do want to emphasize that this intensity of occupation was not something that archaeologists expected to find in this area based on earlier survey work, based on earlier excavations. A few sites were known from the first millennium AD. It was expected that for the time periods before that, for the most part, occupations were fairly small, relatively scattered. We now have to rethink our understanding of how these regions, southwest of Lake Chad, were originally settled and what cultural trajectories were after they were originally settled. And also, if this is general in other areas, in other neighboring areas as well. We've known for some time, for example, that in the first millennium AD, there's significant occupation southeast of Lake Chad. Do they go back to the same cultural roots? Can we trace them back in time to the Gadjigana culture or to some related immigrant cultures, probably, again, from the southern Sahara? So researchers now engaged in investigating the social and political characteristics of these farming populations after, say, 500 BC. There seems to be no evidence of the political centralization or occupational specialization that would allow us to call Zelum and other such communities urban. These were not towns, but they are evidence that from the first millennium BC onwards, the plains south of Lake Chad were occupied by farming communities much larger than anyone had expected. Site sizes and numbers in the first millennium BC are not that great as one proceeds south, away from Lake Chad, toward the Mandara Mountains, the area that I actually work in. In the first millennium BC, further to the south, around the Mandara Mountains, we do not see the kinds of site intensities, large sites, many sites, that existed at the same time at places like Zelum. But by the first millennium AD, around the Mandara Mountains, in Cameroon and Nigeria, where I work, site occupation was beginning to catch up. So we find mound sites, much like the Near Eastern Tell Mounds that I spoke about earlier, all over the region around the Mandara Mountains in the first millennium AD. So, again, significantly large sites when we think of the intensity and the length of occupation that's required to build up artificial mounds from architectural debris and garbage pits. These are especially common, clustered around the edges of the mountains and on the isolated peaks out in the plains to the north of the Mandara Mountains, which probably indicates, at least in part, a need for defense. Even at this time period in the first millennium AD, populations around the Mandara Mountains were siting their settlements in places where they could flee up into the mountains if they were attacked. In excavations at a site called Isadukje, just north of the Mandara Mountains, at the southern edge of the Lake Chad Basin, I found horse remains dating to the middle of the first millennium AD. Isa is contemporary with, for example, Kisi III in Burkina Faso. And in both places, the possession of horses probably was a really important mark of social and political status, as it has been in historical times in the region as well. In historical times, we know from written accounts that horses were owned by leaders and wealthy individuals who could afford the substantial cost of their upkeep. They were the basis for local systems of elite warfare. Conflict south of the Sahara involved commoners who walked or ran and nobles who rode horses. And they were also central to the development of slave raiding and the slave trade in this area, because slave raiding was done very frequently indeed by mounted raiders. This is a network of slave raiding that feeds into the trans-Saharan slave trade. These were slaves who were being traded north to the Mediterranean basin. Interestingly enough, we found to this point nearly a dozen horse skeletons at Isadukje and none at any of the neighboring sites that we've excavated in this region, which may indicate some social or political differences between this very large and complex site of Isadukje and other contemporary communities in the same area. It's difficult to know what we should call the political structures that possibly existed at these sites in the late first millennium BC, in the first millennium AD, in the Lake Chad Basin. They might be identified as small, simple chiefdoms. Anthropological research in recent communities in the area underlines the great complexity and variability of even simple political structures. As communities cycle back and forth between egalitarian and more hierarchical social arrangements, as leaders accumulate different kinds of ritual and political power and have it stolen away from them, and where it's hard to avoid the uneasy feeling that simple terms like chiefdom sometimes mislead more than they illuminate. As in the inland Niger Delta, the early second millennium AD saw the progressive expansion of predatory, militaristic states into the Lake Chad Basin. Prominent among them was Kanem-Bornu, which developed in the late first millennium AD along the northeastern shores of Lake Chad, and also states like Bagirmi in what's now Chad to the southeast. Unfortunately, we know very little about the political and cultural development of the Kanem-Bornu state, primarily because there's been almost no archaeology done northeast of Lake Chad, and because historical texts treating its origins are quite fragmentary. It's likely that Kanem-Bornu gained power at least in part through control of this trans-Saharan slave trade, through the roots of the slave trade that I've talked about, the run from Lake Chad up through the Bilma oases in the central Sahara and north to Tripoli. In this area, slaves, not gold, as in the inland Niger Delta, were probably the main export from this part of sub-Saharan Africa. By the early second millennium AD, Kanem-Bornu dominated the plains east and south of Lake Chad. Over the succeeding centuries, complicated interactions developed between small local states, chiefdoms, and even less centralized societies on the one hand, and large expansionist territorial states like that of Kanem-Bornu on the other. This led to a whole variety of cultural and political responses in the region. Some groups, like the Wandala, who I've mentioned before, became Muslim and competed with Kanem-Bornu on the plains south of Lake Chad, not always successfully. Other populations moved into the Mandara Mountains to escape the attentions of the slave raiders. And this set up a contrast, a cultural contrast, a political and social contrast, even a religious contrast, between those people living in the Mandara Mountains and the states on the plains north of those mountains, running from the mountains toward Lake Chad in the north. This contrast is in some ways represented by artifacts like this, a weapon particularly associated with mountain populations in this area, a weapon used, developed probably from agricultural sickles, but used in defense against slave-raiding attacks from states, predatory, expansionist, militaristic states, occupying the plains to the south of Lake Chad. It represents chiefly authority in the area I work in. We need far more archaeological evidence for how this process happened. Paradoxically, the Mandara Mountains today are so intensively occupied by farmers, the populations I work with, their adaptation to this region has been so successful that archaeological traces of the original occupation of the Mandara Mountains are recycled in the course of agricultural work or simply erased. But one of the responses to this complex process, the expansion of predatory states onto the plains south of Lake Chad and the occupation of refuge areas like the Mandara Mountains, one response was the construction of a somewhat mysterious set of stone monuments known as the DGB, or Degebe sites, that I'm investigating at this point. This is why I've gone back to this area of northern Cameroon, and this is the archaeological field work I'm doing at this point. These are large, complex systems of walls and terraces and platforms and passageways. They are some of the largest dry stone architecture between Axum in Ethiopia and Great Zimbabwe in southeastern Africa, the area I'm going to talk about next. Their construction seems to have been in response to a whole variety of different pressures. They're involved in social and ritual display. They have political implications. And the people who built these sites seem to have had some kind of relations with those predatory states on the plains to the north, perhaps further subcontracting, if you like, in regional slave trades, taking mountain people and trading them into the slave raiding networks to the north. I've also done ethnographic research in this area, which has been very valuable. It allows me to gain some sense of the relationship between the static archaeological traces that we archaeologists excavate, and the complexity of the living communities in this area and elsewhere in the world, but certainly in this area, the Mandara Mountains. The complexity of the living communities that once called these places home. For our next and final lecture about Africa, we'll move to the southeastern part of the continent and look at Great Zimbabwe, one of the most abused and most fantasized archaeological sites in the world. Thank you.